Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters, the Japanese edition. No, that's not true, but normally we cut off the starting music before we get into the lyrics, and today we are decidedly not talking about Japanese food. In fact, we're going to be talking about perhaps the cuisine that is closest to my heart, if you can call it a cuisine, and that is Jewish food. And I'm here, by the way, I should say I'm Mitchell Davis, host of Taste Matters, and I'm here happy to be with Devra First, who is the food editor of the Forward newspaper. Good morning, Devra.
Good morning, Mitchell. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And she's happy, and we're excited that she's happy, too. So the Forward newspaper, those of you who don't know, it's the longest continuously running Jewish newspaper, a daily newspaper, probably in the world, I would imagine. I don't know. Certainly in America,
yeah,
and likely in the world. So you are the food editor of a Jewish newspaper. That must be an exalted position, I imagine, given the importance of food in Jewish culture. Yes, no?
It's definitely a fun role to have, to look at Jewish food, both from the past and the present.
And let's talk about what's going on right now. We don't just have to talk about Jewish food, by the way, because I know that you are a sort of quintessential foodie, an omnivorous foodie who likes all sorts of food. But I am fascinated about some of the things that are happening in Jewish food, because we seem to be in a moment, a renaissance of sorts, of certainly of Ashkenazi Jewish food, but also there's been an influx, I think, of Israeli and Sephardic foods in our consciousness. Can you talk about it? Is this going on?
Absolutely. The Ashkenazi food kind of revival is so exciting. Everything from...
As an Ashkenazi person, I imagine.
Yes, but I think I'd find it exciting even if I didn't come from an Ashkenazi background. It's just exciting to see people kind of a younger generation connecting to food and connecting to a culture and a religion that was sort of forgotten in the food world for a long time. So it's exciting to see Gefilteria and the guys at Kutcher's and Mile End, and it really is reviving. So that's really exciting. And like you said, at the same time, there's also some stuff more under the radio, more under the radar.
Or under the radio. Maybe yes. There's some under the studio. I don't know. Has anyone seen my knish? I think it's rolling around somewhere.
That's going on in the Sephardic world. I mean, Lavara is amazing. And I actually, for those of you guys who are listening, you can't see, there's a book I'm pointing to that's on the table that Yotam Ottolenghi is putting out this fall about Jerusalem. So all about Israeli food. I would love to see the Israeli food kind of come with as much of a full force as the Ashkenazi food is.
So, but what happened? Why do you think it disappeared? I mean, when people think of New York, they think of two types of food. They think of Italian and they think of Jewish food. And yet I remember this very sad moment not that long ago when I was helping a friend who actually be on the show in September, Bonnie Stern, who was planning a Jewish food tour to New York. And we couldn't even think of a restaurant to take people to for a Friday night dinner, not a religious service, but just a good Jewish restaurant, even a great deli. And it seemed there was no place to do that. And yet now things are changing. What do you think happened? Where'd it go?
First of all, the idea that there wasn't a good place for so long is really sad
Isn't
to think
it?
About.
In New York City?
I mean,
it was stunning to us at the time because, you know, we made our lists and we checked them twice. And it was just like, no, actually, we're not interested. Israeli was easier even then. I'm talking 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
But there was no Kutcher's, which would be perfect for a sort of celebration. How did it disappear? I mean, New York is still ambiently Jewish, let's say. The culture of New York is, in many ways, Jewish culture, but not the food. What do you think happened?
I think, to some extent, it's easier to look at why it's coming back. But in terms of why it might have disappeared is, I just don't think Jewish food was looked at as something that could be made to be delicious. Mm. I think people sort of thought, oh, pacha and gefilte fish and things that don't really always go with kind of a more American or more New York palate. And nobody thought, okay, how can we revisit these and make them really delicious? They had sort of fallen by the wayside and been neglected as recipes. And I think now there are people who are really taking time to look at those historic dishes and say, how can we make them delicious? How can we make them a little bit more modern, use local ingredients, and kind of like a Brooklyn sense, food sense applied to them?
So within the last 24 hours, I have heard the word pacha three times. It was drawn to me in a meeting, and I know what it is. I did write a Jewish cookbook. I was at Mission Chinese last night, where Florence Fabricant happened to be having dinner, and she said we had to try the pig's ear terrine because it was just like pacha. And you've just said it again. So you have to explain it, and you have to, we have to figure out what, I mean, I guess it's just evidence that there is something happening.
I actually might let you explain it. I've never been a huge fan of it, so I'm not as familiar with it as I would like to be. It's kind of like,
it's like a jellied soup. I mean, it's made from a calf's foot generally, yeah. Right? But it's sort of like an aspic or a gelatin, but
it's jellied meat. It's kind of gross.
And if you want to know, well, except that this pig's ear terrine, which is not exactly a Jewish delicacy, at Mission Chinese had a sort of beautiful gelatinous quality to it that was sliced and sauced and whatever.
Rather, so, I should say, I might find it gross only because gelatinous food is kind of the only food that I must have gotten really sick from it when I was a kid, and it's something I've never been able to get on board with.
Not Jell-O also? Maybe you had, no. Oh, gross. Okay. Okay, so no pacha for your birthday, Devra, for your birthday dinner. So let's go back also, and let's talk about what we're describing for folks at home who may not know what the difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews and what that implies in the food.
So Ashkenazi and Jewish food, or Ashkenazis and Sephardim, sort of the separation is the Jews who went to Eastern Europe are called Ashkenazis, and the Jews who went to Spain and then out from Spain were called Sephardim. And I think both groups really cooked with what was available and sort of adapted the local cuisines, what made them kosher, and combined them with Jewish traditions. And so when you talk about Ashkenazi food, you're usually talking about deli, you're talking about lots of things with potatoes and cabbage and things that exist in Eastern Europe and in Poland. And then when you're talking about the Sephardim, it's a lot more fresh fruit and vegetables, different spices. Sort of the only spice that in the Ashkenazi world is maybe paprika and some salt, whereas in the Sephardic world, there's cumin and coriander, sort of more vibrant flavors.
Uh-huh. And again, just from the surroundings, that sometimes I think we think of Jewish food as being kosher food, but actually kosher is something else, and obviously yes. It plays into Jewish food, but the food of Jews is not, there were no recipes in the Bible, as Barbara Cushing Black Gimlet likes to say, except for matzah, really, flour and water.
Right.
But Jews adapted where they lived, the kosher laws, to the ingredients they had at hand. And that's sort of the phenomenon you're describing.
Certainly. I think some of the, while there weren't recipes in the Bible, there are certainly Jewish customs that were adapted both by Ashkenazim and Sephardim in different ways. The idea of eating something sweet on Rosh Hashanah, whether that's honey or whether it's tzimis, which is a sweetened carrot dish. So there are, Jewish food, I think, is, yes, it's separate from kosher food, and yes, it's the food that Jews made based upon what was around, but it is also linked to Jewish custom and to ideas that go back very, very far in history.
And is it that custom of or those customs about food that makes Jews like food so much or so into food? I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to understand. I think it's a funny phenomenon when bagels and knishes or pastrami sandwiches and corned beef and those sorts of corned beef sandwiches and deli have become to represent New York City, which is sort of an American city, an American ideal. But really, these are Jewish things that sort of grew. I guess you could say the same of pizza being Italian, but also people associate it with us. But do you think is there something inherent in the culture that makes food so important, even if it's kosher?
I think food does play I think you could maybe even argue that it goes back to religious roots, that food plays such a large role in Jewish custom in observance of religion. I'm hearing the Beatles in the background here. Sorry.
It's okay.
So
we are in the middle of a restaurant actually just off to the side of a restaurant.
Yeah. So I think that some of it comes from that, and also just from culture, from if you go, I mean, sort of the cliche of being at a Jewish home and that you're going to be sort of the Jewish mother is going to force feed you, that sort of stereotype really does have some truth to it, that there's always Jewish food or always food in a Jewish home. And so I think that there is a deep love of food in Jewish custom.
Right. It's funny when you look at some of the great food writers of New York, which may have something to do with it too, whether it's Mimi Sheridan or Ray Sokoloff or, I mean, even Jeffrey Steingarten or Alan Richman. They're all these, they're Jews. Maybe they like to eat and talk about it, or eat and write about it and think about it in a certain way. Is there something unique? Let's go back to what's happening right now, the trends. Tell us a little bit about what you see. You mentioned Gefilteria, you mentioned Kutcher's. Actually, today at the James Beard Foundation, for our Beard on Books, we have Sander Katz, who's
written
The
That's
Art
great.
Of Fermentation, which, I mean, isn't necessarily a Jewish book, but fermentation and pickles and
he's
sauerkraut.
Also very Jewy.
Jewy, is that what we Jewy foodie? Is that what we call them? So, like, tell me more about what's happening right now in the city and even outside the city. What you see?
I think I see sort of two things. One of which is caught up, and people see in the media, which is this revival of Ashkenazi Jewish food that's not kosher. That's Mile End and Kutcher's and all the places that you mentioned, and that is so exciting, and people really connecting to their roots through this food.
But also people who aren't Jewish connecting to this food.
Absolutely.
I think, right? Without the roots.
I mean, Jeff Yaskowitz has talked to me. Jeff Yaskowitz is one of the owners of Filteria, and he's actually been on this show before. And he's talked to me about that it's a way for our generation to sort of reconnect to Judaism. But I think at the same time, one thing that's sort of being ignored or doesn't get as much attention in sort of mainstream media is that there is also sort of this other end of the spectrum. There are the people who keep kosher, mm-hmm. who are going as far from Jewish food and Jewish food customs as possible. Within the realm of keeping kosher, I mean, Jezebel, which just opened in Tribeca, which I haven't had the fortune to eat there yet, Kutcher's Tribeca is three blocks away, and they couldn't be more different in terms of what food they're serving.
What sort of food are they serving? Or explain a little bit the phenomenon. I think I know where you're going, but explain what you're talking about.
I think there's sort of this phenomenon in the kosher world of trying to make everything that exists outside of the kosher world kosher, and trying to give people who keep strictly kosher the opportunity to taste cuisines from around the world and to taste what everybody else is eating in Manhattan.
Sure.
And that in and of itself is a huge challenge for a chef and is interesting and I think is often sort of overlooked.
Right. As a whole trend in Jewish food. It's certainly when I wrote my book, The Ment Chef, one of the challenges was to explain that it wasn't necessarily a book for Jews who were observant and kept kosher because they weren't going to eat these foods, or they had their own traditions for those foods. They're looking for these other foods. They
Absolutely.
Want recipes for Chinese food or other things that because the food movement is happening. And as you said, the customs are adaptive to their environment. And right now you can't do anything. You can't be anywhere or read anything or see anything that isn't talking about some food from somewhere. What are the challenges in that, do you think? I mean, besides the obvious, the pork, which is pervasive and seems to be, you know, if you want to be taken seriously, something has to have bacon in it. That's not happening in those restaurants.
I mean, I think pork is a huge challenge because it has such a distinct flavor and it really is. I mean, we're sitting in Roberta's, as I said to you beforehand. There's a face bacon. There's a guanciale pizza here that's very popular. And bacon really is so pervasive in the food movement at the moment. So I think recreating that flavor is a real challenge. I also think desserts are incredibly challenging because in the kosher world, it's kind of, if you're going out for a fancy dinner, it will almost always involve meat. And people who keep kosher don't mix, as you know, milk and meat. And so I think there's a huge challenge of how do you make really delicious desserts that don't have butter, that don't have any dairy. So that's a big challenge. And I also think there is some challenge of getting the community on board with something that's really, really different. Pardes in Brooklyn has, I mean, the chef there, Moses Wendell, used to be the chef at this fantastic restaurant that no longer exists in Philadelphia called Django. And Django did the beautiful kind of smaller plates, like wonderful food from all around Western Europe. The menu was designed after Django Reinhardt's trip, like his tour around Europe. And I think Moses Wendell has brought some of that sensibility to the kosher community. And I think that there's been, I mean, one of the complaints that you sometimes hear from the kosher world is that the portions there are really small because they're...
Okay, that's a Jackie Mason joke.
But I also think that it's just, it's different. And for there are people in the kosher world who are really excited about the changes in the kosher world. And I think that there are people who are still a little bit hesitant and are just starting to get more comfortable with some of the differences between the more traditional kosher restaurants and the kosher restaurants that are sort of looking outside of the kosher community for their inspiration.
Interesting. I think we'll take a break there. I'll remind people listening that you can actually call in questions, so think about them, and they could be about anything about Jewish food, even perhaps what you're making for Rosh Hashanah or the holidays coming up. And you can call us at 718-497-2128, or you can email us questions at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or you can tweet us at Taste Matters HRN, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Deborah First from The Forward.
I'd have 4 loving arms to embrace you, 4 eyes to idolize you each time I face you. With 2 hearts twice as true, what couldn't 4 lips do? When 4 ears hear you say that I'm yours, da da da. I wish that I were twins. You great.
You're listening to Plexophonic.
So I will. Twice as much as
I wish I were twins.
I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Funny how that works. And I'm talking to Deborah First, who is, among other things, the editor, the food editor. I keep forgetting that, but I think there should only be food editors. So I think all editors should be food editors. But anyway, Deborah First, the
you
editor.
You just gave me a huge promotion, Mitchell.
I did. And we're going to double your whatever, your salary. I'm going to say we're going to double your expense account or something and give you more food. Deborah First, the food editor of The Forward, which is the longest continuously running Jewish newspaper in America, we know, and maybe elsewhere. And I think I'd like to talk here a little bit about what you do and what you cover, given sort of some of the different threads going on. I mean, the job must have changed and evolved over the generations of the paper. And so tell us what you look for when you're writing about food in this for this community.
I'm really interested in Jewish food culture, much more so than I am in kind of the kosher world, which there is a whole world of food blogs. I mean, Joy of Kosher and this woman, Jamie Geller, really has that world covered. I'm really interested in a lot of what we've been talking about, kind of what's going on in New York, and a lot of that sort of stuff is going on in San Francisco, mm-hmm. too, trying to make really good bagels in San Francisco and the old world food cart in San Francisco, which serves blintzes and matzo ball soup out of a cart. And I haven't gotten to eat there yet, but everybody says it's really fabulous. So I'm really interested in that sort of stuff. And we cover a good amount of cookbooks. We're always interested to see, especially the cookbooks that have like a real story behind them, that aren't just recipes and tell you a bit about the history of different Jewish foods. Is something we try to cover pretty well.
I just actually slipped through some galleys of a Yemenite cookbook that's coming out that was really interesting, I thought, with lots of stories and information of a whole sect of Jews or a group of Jews that I didn't even know about, who have very distinct food cultures. And do you recipes, or is that...
We definitely do. We always have, on Wednesdays, we do a post called Shabbat Meals, which is always kind of the story behind a recipe that someone had for Shabbat, but it's not usually a traditional dish. It's everything from the one I wrote, which I think was one of the first ones we ran, was about the fact that my family always, always has fish on Friday night. It's just been, we have a fishmonger we go see every Friday morning, and so I think the recipe I wrote was for snapper Provençal, which is pretty typical Friday night dinner in my family.
It's almost Catholic, right?
Yeah.
We always had roast chicken for Friday night.
So we definitely, we do recipes, at least for that. And then kind of when other things arise, when there's a recipe that can tell a story, you were saying, for example, the Yemeni cookbook. One of the things I'm incredibly interested in is that there's so many Jewish food cultures that are smaller that so often get overlooked. There's a whole Jewish community in India that has this amazing history and has their own recipes. And there are pockets of Jews kind of all around the world who have developed their own kind of iterations of Jewish cuisine. And so whenever we write about those, it's really important to me to make sure that we include a recipe so people, if you can't travel a couple thousand miles, can try that sort of food at home.
Interesting. I'll remind people that if you have questions for Devra or about Jewish food trends, about where to find a good matzo ball from a street cart in San Francisco, or if you want to talk about what you're cooking for your holidays, you can reach us at 718-497-2128. You can tweet us at Taste Matters HRN or email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. And someone has emailed a question that actually pertains to something that you just brought up. And the question is about the relationship between new food trends and the holidays, where we often look for traditional foods or things that we've had in our family for generations. Do you think these trends are changing tastes, our listener asks, and the menus at meals made for Passover Seders or Rosh Hashanah dinner in people's homes? An interesting question, especially...
Absolutely.
Do you see that?
I think holidays are the trickiest thing, because people do want to stick to something that's traditional often, and I have a lot of respect for that. If your family always makes your grandmother's brisket, and that brisket has an amazing story behind it of how it came from Europe to the States, and that's something that's totally worth preserving. But it is also really fun to see people, especially I think for Passover, for some reason, maybe because Passover is longer or because it is this idea that we're retelling a story that we should feel, you know, that we were slaves in Egypt and that we were freed from Egypt. People really are taking a lot more liberty with Passover, especially for second Seders, which is so exciting to see. The Beard Foundation.
Yes. I will be cooking a second Seder this year at the James Beard Foundation, although it's going to be my mother's brisket, my grandmother's brisket. It's going to be pretty traditional. But
when Mile N did it for you guys, they really thought about, okay, how can we take the symbolism of the Seder plate and sort of reinterpret it on the dinner plate? And so the lamb shank became the main course of the dinner.
Right.
The Seder that I cooked with my dad for our family this past year for the second Seder, instead of serving parsley, we served chimichurri. And instead of having an egg, we made like an Iranian green frittata that was for the egg course. And so, I know I'm not the only person doing this. Lots of people have told me about it, especially, I think, for Passover. I think for Rosh Hashanah, if people want to change things up, maybe do traditional one day and take advantage of the fact that there's a second day to do something a little bit different. I think what's really fun is to take sort of the ideas of, you know, the idea of Rosh Hashanah is you want to start something for the head of the year. And so you want something sweet and something sort of like from the fall harvest, maybe. And so to take those ideas that originally inspired the dishes that we eat for Rosh Hashanah and to try it with something new.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the conundrum of food writers everywhere. It isn't unique to Jewish food. That Thanksgiving comes, it's the November issue of the magazine, and everyone really just wants the same things they've had every year for Thanksgiving, but that's not an interesting story. And so you give them 26 new dishes, 27 ways to make a turkey, and maybe some people do it, and maybe they do it and everyone complains that next year we just want mom's turkey. I mean,
this is why I have three different Thanksgiving dinners. I'm not exaggerating.
Really? That's
I have
funny.
Three.
That's good. So how does that break down? Because you get two Jewish holiday dinners, and so you wanted to one better, you know, Erev Thanksgiving and then Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving is my favorite day of the year. I start celebrating about 3 weeks in advance. The first Thanksgiving is a Thanksgiving I host for my friends in New York, which is a little bit traditional, but we ask everybody to bring a dish that's important to them. Wow. And I make the turkey and my family's really bizarre cranberry walnut orange relish. The second one is Tom Hanksgiving, which is an annual holiday two of my friends throw that I wrote about for Serious Eats. It's all in honor of Tom Hanks. And last year we had turkey that was made like Peking duck, and we put it in pork buns, and that was everything has like funny names, and
oh my God, how
it's hysterical.
Funny.
And then the third Thanksgiving is with my family, where we have our Thanksgiving in my family is really all about my Uncle Richard's selection of cheese. Last year, there were 22 varieties.
Oh my
you get
God.
A map when you walk in the house of where the cheeses are and where they're from and what you should pair them with. And so, yes, I have three Thanksgivings.
So you come to your food interests naturally. It's part of the family tradition, not just the Jewish heritage and your job. You are the first person I've heard who has an annual ritual outside Thanksgiving for Thanksgiving besides us. We do a Thanksgiving that was a dry run.
Really?
Yeah. We weren't supposed to be talking about things. It's not the Thanksgiving show, but while we're here, because
it's such a fabulous food holiday.
The first year my husband, Nate, who is probably listening, was making Thanksgiving for his family. He wanted to test everything. He was too nervous to do it for the family right away. So he invited all of his friends to do everything. And now we do two Thanksgivings 3 weeks apart.
That.
3 or 4 weeks apart. So I love that there's more of that. In fact, on our Thanksgiving show, maybe we'll have an alternate Thanksgiving show. That's what we're going to do. We're going to have people write in and talk to us about things that are Thanksgiving, not on Thanksgiving. In fact, that which speaks to the Jewish traditions also in my family, this shows you how religious we were. We moved the holidays generally. They were more convenient to the weekends or whatever it was, because it was just about the meals.
Absolutely.
Admittedly. And the foods that you only had at those times of year. Do you get a lot of requests requests for help at the newspaper when it comes to cooking? I mean, is there a community of Jewish foodies reading you regularly, or is it more a sort of general interest, or this is what's happening?
I'd really like to think so. We're actually this year hoping to have to give people the opportunity to write in with questions, and then we'll have various different food writers respond to them, whether you have a question about how to make brisket or how to make an apple cake for Rosh Hashanah. I think that I would love to think that there is this community of Jewish foodies, and there certainly is in Brooklyn. And we all sort of ask each other questions about how do you make gefilte fish, and how do you make kvass, and how do you make pickles at home?
Right.
So yeah, I think there is a community of people who are interested in that and are trying to figure it out. And I think the questions that I love absolutely the most are people who are my age, who are in their late 20s, who are just for the first time starting to host these, whether it's to host Rosh Hashanah dinner, host Seder, and people who are trying to figure out how do they mix tradition with something that their foodies and something that's personal to them. And, you know, how do you cook a dinner for your family for 12 people? It is, I totally understand Nate being nervous. It's intimidating.
Daunting. Yeah, of course. Especially if you don't cook all the time. That's the thing about Thanksgiving or any of these holidays. If that's the one time you cook, it's like you go to the Olympics and you haven't trained, you know, it's showtime.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Have to do something. Well, it's been really great to talk to you. People can read you regularly on The Jew and the Carrot, which is your blog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's more of the same, a sort of a long, bigger conversation than what appears in the printed paper, I presume? Or
yeah, so people can check us out in the foreword. Every month there is a food page, and we have a couple of food special sections throughout the year. We have a really great one coming out the beginning of September for the holidays, and also check us out on the blog, The Jew and the Carrot. Some more conversations like what we're having right here. Uh-huh.
And we are going to be back next Wednesday, and I don't remember right now who my guest is. Oh, Karen Karp is going to be here, and she is going to be guest hosting because I'm not going to be here. In fact, I'm not going to be back next Wednesday, but every Wednesday you can certainly find a conversation about taste here at theheritageradionetwork.com on Taste Matters, and you can listen to us on our podcast that you can download from iTunes. You can also go to the archive at heritageradionetwork.org, where they have all of our shows on a wide variety of topics, some shows sometimes within one show, as today we're talking about Jewish food and Thanksgiving traditions. Thank you, Deborah, for being here.
Thanks
for having me. In the meantime, everybody, do yourself a favor and eat something delicious.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.